Chapter 7, Islam Becomes an Empire, The Fight for Mecca. Muhammad lived in Medina for 2 years. The Muslims who had come to Medina from Mecca obeyed Muhammad's teachings and did whatever he commanded, and soon so did the people who had always lived in Medina. They came to him with their difficulties and their questions. "Muhammad," one man might say, "I promised to pay my neighbor 2 pieces of gold for his camel. I gave him the gold, and he gave me the camel. I took the camel home, but the next morning it was dead. He sold me a sick camel. Shouldn't I get my money back?" Then Muhammad would decide whether the man would get his money back. Now Muhammad was more than just a prophet. He was also the ruler of a city. He had to be a judge and a king, as well as a preacher. And the people of Medina followed the laws that Muhammad made. "Be kind to your parents," he ordered his followers. "Be loyal to other Muslims. Always watch out for them. Don't drink wine or eat pork. Those things are bad for you. And take care of your families." Muhammad's new laws made life in Medina peaceful. But the city of Medina had other problems. There was barely enough food and water in Medina to take care of the people who had always lived there. And now Muhammad's followers, all the Muslims who had fled from Mecca, needed food and water as well. Soon people in Medina began to go hungry. So several of the city leaders went to visit Muhammad. "Prophet," they said, "our children are hungry. There's barely enough water to keep us alive. What will we do?" Muhammad thought for a long while. Finally he said, "Go out to the high road and wait until you see a caravan of camels taking food and supplies to the city of Mecca. Then attack the caravan and take the food. Bring it back here to Medina and share it with those who are hungry." So Muhammad's followers armed themselves with short curved swords and round shields. They went out to the road and stole from the caravan headed for Mecca, just as Muhammad had commanded. For weeks the Muslims raided the caravans headed for Mecca. Soon the leaders of Mecca grew angry. "What will happen to us here in Mecca?" they complained. "The caravans are empty when they arrive at our walls. If we don't stop Muhammad and his followers, we will begin to go hungry ourselves." So the army of Mecca marched out towards Medina. When Muhammad heard that Mecca's army was on its way, he gathered his own army together and marched out to meet them. The two armies met in a dry riverbed and fought until the Meccans admitted defeat. The army of Mecca retreated, and Muhammad declared victory. But the quarrel between Mecca and Medina didn't end. The two cities fought with each other for 7 more years. Meanwhile, Muhammad and his men convinced more and more Arabian tribes to become Muslims. Now Muhammad had many allies willing to fight with him, and Muhammad declared Mecca to be a holy place. "From now on," he told his followers, "you must always pray facing towards the city of Mecca. This will show that you turn only to Allah Himself when you pray." Now the Muslims wanted to conquer Mecca more than ever. Finally, Muhammad and 10,000 Muslim followers marched towards Mecca. When the weary, battle-scarred Meccans saw Muhammad's huge force, they surrendered. The Muslims entered Mecca triumphantly. They burned all the idols in the city and declared it the holy city of Islam. "Only Muslims will be allowed to enter Mecca from this day on," Muhammad declared. "Any unbelievers who enter will be put to death." Mecca is still the holy city of Islam today. Do you remember the fifth pillar of Islam? Every faithful Muslim tries to visit Mecca at least once during his lifetime. The spread of Islam. Now Muhammad ruled in Mecca. Soon Muhammad and his followers ruled most of the Arabian Peninsula too. More and more Arabian tribes became Muslims, and Muhammad went on telling them what Allah wanted them to do. Now Islam wasn't just a religion followed by a few tribes in the Arabian desert. Islam had its own empire, an empire as big as Arabia. Muhammad was the leader of this empire, but one day Muhammad complained that he had a headache. He lay down to rest and never got up again. The prophet was dead. Now what would happen to the empire of Islam? Muhammad was the prophet of Allah. Who else could tell the people what Allah required? The Muslims of Mecca gathered together to ask each other what they should do next, and many of them began to panic. "Can anyone else lead us?" they asked. "What if Islam vanishes now that Muhammad is dead? What if our whole nation falls apart?" But Muhammad's friend Abu Bakr stood up. Do you remember Abu Bakr? He was with Muhammad in Mecca when the leaders of the city were trying to kill Muhammad. "Friends," Abu Bakr said, "Muhammad is only the messenger of Allah. We follow Allah alone. Muhammad may be dead, but Islam lives." When the Muslims heard Abu Bakr's words, they became calmer. But they still needed a strong leader to govern the empire that Muhammad had built. So they chose Abu Bakr to be their new leader, or caliph. The caliph of the Islamic Empire ruled over all the people who believed in Allah. Abu Bakr wasn't a big, powerful man. He was small, thin, and dressed in shabby clothes. He was gentle and soft-spoken. But Abu Bakr, the first Islamic caliph, kept Islamic rule over Arabia strong. He ordered Muslim soldiers to attack and conquer any Bedouin tribes who rebelled against Islamic laws. But this was only the beginning for the Islamic Empire. The caliphs who came after Abu Bakr attacked the Byzantine Empire and took away some of its land. They spread Islam all the way up to the Caspian Sea. They conquered the land to the east of them, almost all the way over to India, and they took over North Africa, the part of Africa closest to the Mediterranean Sea. Islam had started as the religion of one man, Muhammad. But now it had become much more. Hundreds of thousands of people now worshipped Allah, and Islam wasn't just a religion, it was an empire. The caliphs of the Islamic Empire built a new capital city on the banks of the Tigris River. The city was round, with three walls surrounding it. The caliphs called it Baghdad. Mecca was still the holy city of Islam, but Baghdad, the round city, became the center of the empire. The caliph lived there in a splendid palace. Ships sailed to Baghdad from far away to trade silks from China, spices from India, and gold and gems from all over the world. Baghdad became one of the busiest and most beautiful cities in the world. The City of Baghdad. The City of Baghdad was known for its beautiful buildings, its running water, its public libraries, and its thinkers. Philosophers, scientists, astronomers, and writers came to Baghdad to study, to learn, and to write books. One of the most famous Islamic books, The Thousand and One Nights, takes place in the palace of the caliph in Baghdad. In the book, sailors, soldiers, and explorers tell the caliph all about their adventures. One of the sailors is named Sinbad. Sinbad tells this story about himself. "When I was a young man, I had more money than the king. I bought myself the best food, the finest drink, and the most beautiful clothing. I did nothing but eat, drink, and go to parties with my friends. But one day I discovered that my money was almost gone, and I had done nothing all my life but enjoy myself. I thought, before it is too late, I want to have an adventure and make a name for myself. When people hear my name, they will think, 'Sinbad was a great explorer, braver than a lion.' So I sold everything I had left, even my fancy clothes. I used the money to buy clothes for traveling and food for a long journey. Then I went down to the harbor and set sail with a group of merchants heading for foreign lands. We sailed over the sea for weeks and weeks, stopping at one island after another to trade and to buy. We were tired of sailing and weary from our trading when we saw ahead of us the most beautiful island in the world. It looked like paradise. Tall green trees shaded soft, lush meadows. Flowers grew blue, yellow, and scarlet along the edges of clear running streams. 'Land!' called out the captain. 'Let's sink our anchor here and rest for a while.' So we all left the ship, anchored on the shore, and wandered through the dim, cool gardens and sunny fields. Some of the men built fires on the shore and roasted meat for a feast. Others swam in the sparkling streams and washed their clothes. I walked in the grass, for it had been a long time since I had felt solid ground under my feet. I could smell the roasting meat on the breeze, and the scent of food made me hungry. I thanked Allah that He had brought us to this beautiful place where we could rest and eat. Suddenly, I heard frantic shouts coming from the shore. The captain had climbed back on board our boat, where it lay up against the sand. He was screaming, "Run! Run for your lives! Leave your clothes and food and get on board! Allah save us! This is no island! It's a fish!" And when I looked around me, I saw that he was right. A great fish, as big as a mountain, had settled in the middle of the sea. It had been there so long that sand washed up on it, and trees grew in the dirt. Covered with ground and grass, the fish looked like an island. But when our sailors built fires on the shore, the fish felt the heat and began to move. I could feel the ground shaking beneath my feet as the fish shuddered and twisted. Dirt began to fall away from the fish's gigantic back. Beneath my feet, I could see glittering moss-grown scales. A huge eye rolled up at me. The fish was awake and angry. Men were fleeing back to the ship, leaving their pots, their food, and their clothes on the heaving sand. But I was too far away. I was still running across the sand when the fish shook itself and leapt high into the air. Trees, grass, flowers, and streams all flew away in a cloud of destruction. And then the fish hit the surface of the water with a thundering crash. Water sprang up all around it, high as a mountain, as it dived down into the surging sea. Waves swept over me. My eyes and mouth were filled with water. I kicked frantically, seeing only the glitter of green sea all around me. I could hear the shouts and cries of my fellow sailors also struggling in the sea. I thought that I would drown, but Allah sent my way a wooden tub washed from the island. I climbed into it and huddled in the bottom while the waves tossed me this way and that, and as I watched, our ship disappeared into the distance. The terrified captain was sailing away as fast as he could, ignoring the shouts of the men stranded in the sea. Night came. All that night and all the next day, I sailed in my wooden tub, pushed about by the wind and waves. I suffered terribly from thirst and hunger. The sun beat down on me. When I dangled my feet over the tub's edge to cool them in the seawater, fish rose to the surface and nibbled at my soles. But as dark began to close around me again, I saw that the tide was carrying me towards a mountain island, with trees bending from its sides almost down to the water's surface. My tub washed beneath a tree, and I grabbed its branches and pulled myself up onto land. My legs were numb and cramping, and I had not slept since the fish island dove into the deeps beneath me. So I threw myself down on the shore and slept like a dead man until the next morning. When I awoke, I managed to get to my feet and look about me. I found trees that bore sweet figs and apples and springs of fresh sweet water. So I ate until I was full and drank until I was no longer thirsty. I thanked Allah for sparing my life and began to explore the island. Birds sang sweetly in the trees above me. The soft smell of flowers drifted past me, but I could not see any sign of man. Was I alone on this island? I climbed a tall tree so that I could look around in all directions, but I saw nothing but sand, trees, the sky, and the mountain rising above me. I looked and I looked for some sign of life. Surely I could not be the only man on this island. Finally, I saw far away on the other side of the mountain some great white thing in the middle of the trees. It was too smooth to be a rock. Perhaps it was a building. I noted its direction, climbed down from the tree, and began to walk towards it. I struggled through the underbrush and over rocks for hours until my feet were cut and bleeding. Finally, I arrived at a clearing in the trees. In the center of the trees, a huge white dome rose to the sky. I walked all around it, but there was no door or window in any wall. I beat on it with my fists, but it was not made of stone. The thick white walls were warm and hard, and I could not make any dent in them. I tried to climb up it, but the sides were so smooth and slippery that I could only get a few feet off the ground before I slid off and fell. By now, the sun was sinking towards the sea. Dusk was creeping up around me. I thought that I should find myself a place to sleep. But as I turned away to look for shelter, I saw the sky grow suddenly dark. The light of the sun was blotted out. The air grew cold around me. I thought that a cloud had come over the sun. But then I saw that an enormous bird, as wide as a cloud and as tall as a mountain, had swooped down over my head. So large was this bird that it blotted out the sun. I was so amazed that I fell down on the ground, hoping that the bird would not see me. And I remembered that I had once heard a sailor tell of a huge bird called a roc that lives on faraway islands and feeds elephants to its babies. Then I knew that the enormous dome was the roc's egg. Sinbad in the Valley of Snakes. The gigantic bird settled down on the dome, spread its wings over its head, and fell asleep. So I got carefully up, unwound my turban from my head, and made a rope from the cloth. Then I tied the cloth around my middle, crept up to the roc, and tied the other end to its thick, scaly leg. For I thought to myself, if the bird flies away, maybe it will take me to a land where there are people and cities, and then I will escape from this island. I was afraid to go to sleep. What if the roc flew away while I was sleeping? So I spent the whole night sitting with my back against the roc's egg, my waist tied to its foot, waiting for it to wake up. When the first light of the sun glowed red in the sky, the roc stirred. It spread its wings and rose up off its egg, carrying me with it. We rose so high into the sky that I thought we would leave the earth altogether and travel into the darkness of the air beyond. And below me the island and its dome were the size of grains of salt, scattered on the blue of the sea. Finally, the roc flew over land. Little by little, it began to descend, coming closer and closer to earth. As soon as my feet touched the ground, I began to untie myself. I was shaking with fear. What if the roc took off again? Or what if it saw me and pecked me up from the earth like a grain of corn? But the bird never spotted me, and as soon as I was free, I ran away from it as quickly as I could. Soon I saw it snatch something from the ground with its enormous claws and rise back up into the air. It carried a snake, as long as a tree and as big around as a man. I kept walking until I found myself at the edge of a valley. Through the valley ran a river too wide to cross, and tall mountains stood all around the valley's sides. Then I thought to myself, I should have stayed on the island. At least there I had fruit to eat and water to drink. Here I have no food and no water, and I can never cross those mountains. Soon I recovered my courage and began to climb down into the valley. As soon as I put my feet to the ground, I saw that it was studded with diamonds as big as my fist. I filled my pockets, my turban, and my cloak all full of diamonds. Perhaps I can make a raft, I thought, and float down the river until I come to a city. But as I came close to the river, I saw that the shores were swarming with snakes as big as palm trees that would swallow an elephant in one gulp. I was too afraid to go further. What can I do? I cried out. I will never escape this place. And where can I sleep to be safe from the snakes? For night was beginning to fall. As I staggered along, weary and frightened, I saw ahead of me a flat place with a cliff rising up above it. Eagles circled around it. As I watched, a piece of meat fell from the cliff onto the ground, and an eagle swept down and seized the meat. I looked up. There, far above me, were men. They were throwing down large pieces of meat into the valley below, and then I saw that this was how the men of this land got diamonds out of the dangerous valley of the snakes. When they threw pieces of meat down on top of the diamonds, some of the precious stones would stick to the meat. Then an eagle would swoop down, seize the meat, and carry it back up to the land above. As soon as the eagle settled to eat, the men would run at it, waving sticks and shouting to scare it away. Then they would take away the diamonds that had stuck to the meat and leave the meat itself for the eagle to eat. As soon as I understood this, I ran and grabbed hold of one of the pieces of meat and held it up over my head. An eagle swooped down on it and seized it with its claws. Then he flew back up out of the valley with me dangling beneath him, holding on to the meat with all my strength. As soon as my feet touched the mountainside, I let go of the piece of meat and ran towards the men at the cliff's edge. They were disappointed to see that they had caught only another man, rather than a handful of diamonds. But I said to them, "Don't worry, I am an honest man, and Allah has delivered me from the Valley of the Snakes. Out of gratitude, I will give you some of the diamonds I have brought with me." Then I gave handfuls of diamonds to all of them. When I told them my story, they were amazed, for no one before had ever come alive from the Valley of the Snakes.